Jeffrey, hello.
Hi, Andreas. How are you?
Good. Thank you for taking an evening to discuss your new book with me, Spent: Sex, Evolution, and Consumer Behavior. What made you write the book?
I wrote the book because I realized that marketing and consumer behavior are dominant forces in contemporary culture all around the world. And as an evolutionary psychologist, I thought I had a pretty good grasp on human nature. And realizing how many insights you could get from evolution to understand people was really one great scientific revolution for me. That happened when I was at Stanford as a PhD student. I thought nothing could ever seem quite as exciting again intellectually as that insight, that evolution matters for psychology. But then about 10 years ago, when I was working in an economics department at University College London, I started thinking hard about economic behavior and marketing and branding and consumerism, and I realized that consumerism is so central to modern culture that it's really the counterpart to human nature. To the same extent that evolution gives insight into human nature, emotions, motivations, I think marketing and consumer behavior gives insights into all of contemporary culture and human life.
So reflecting back on when we met at Stanford 20 years ago, you took me to the first class I attended Dave Ruhmelhardt taught, who became then, as you know, my PhD advisor. And I was a data guy. I was a data guy then, I'm a data guy now. However, I give talks in marketing departments, I teach in marketing departments, and it's interesting how your deep-rooted belief and experience about the power of the evolution framework and my deep-rooted belief in the power of coming up with different ways of doing things and just measuring what works better, whether it was at Slack when we first met or whether it was at Amazon, that those two, at first sight, very different approaches actually tend to come to the same conclusion.
I think it's not that surprising because I think a really strong theory, like evolutionary biology as applied to the human mind, if it's a good strong theory, if it actually makes testable predictions and leads to a fruitful, progressive set of research traditions, is going to arrive at the same conclusions that really rich, detailed data mining will arrive at. I think they're very complementary in that sense. And I think, moreover, that you know, the stronger the theory you have, the deeper your data analysis can go. And conversely, the richer your data sets, the easier it is to refine theory progressively, iteratively, to make it better and better, to get better and better insights into the consumer.
I think you're right that the 90s was about, given a data set, what insights can we get? I think we now, however, have moved to a regime where the question has flipped. Given a problem, what data can we get? I call this the social data revolution, where social means shared data. And it's primarily actually a consumer mind shift which is happening. I used to call it the consumer data revolution, but you know, we are not really consumers in Facebook at first sight, so that's when I moved to the term social data revolution. So one of the key aspects is that of openness. Now, by virtue of, you know, you right now being in Australia, I'm German, live here, have a house in Shanghai. So I think we are sort of at one end of the distribution in terms of experiencing the world. And I remember a housemate of mine, when we went to a restaurant and we both saw a dish neither of us knew, I would say, let's try it. And they said, oh, no, of course, let's not try it. We don't know what it will be like. What are your deep insights into openness as a character trait of people?
Openness is one of the what's called the Big Five personality traits. So it's one of the most fundamental differences that characterize people. The Big Five are not actually widely known in marketing or consumer behavior, which is a shame because there's such a strong consensus now.
They come out of Oregon?
Psychology. They come out of a whole tradition of empirical research on personality since about 1980. And they've been validated genetically. They're all heritable within families. They're valid across cultures. And they predict a huge range of behavior. So one of these Big Five traits, openness, I think is particularly interesting because it's about responsiveness to novelty, interest in new ideas, new cultures, new products. And it's also one of the things that people assort on, people match on. Highly open people like to have highly open mates, spouses, friends, and colleagues. People who are more conventional, low on openness, are also much more comfortable with others who are more conventional, low on openness. So it sounds like quite an intuitive trait. It sounds easy to understand, but it's actually quite neglected in terms of the implications.
So we probably can't understand that our openness might make people very uncomfortable.
It's very, very hard for the highly open to appreciate what life is like for those low in openness. That all of the wild contemporary art that we enjoy, all of the electronic music, all of the new foods from other cultures, all of the travel that we do, we just think it's fun. And we think it's wonderful and enriching and energizing. To those who are low in openness, it's all threatening. It's destabilizing. It creates anxiety, worry, aversion. It even can create various forms of disgust. As when people say, oh, that work of art is disgusting. I don't understand it. I have a gut reaction that's very negative to it. I think this is a problem in business because people in marketing and advertising and branding tend to be quite high on openness themselves. And that makes it very hard for them to have strong personal insight into most of the consumers they're trying to reach who are much lower in openness than they are.
I have somebody from Twitter coming to class tomorrow. And it being a very new communication paradigm where people are super open in sharing their experiences, not just with their friends, as in Facebook, mutually confirmed, but I always say C2W, consumer to world. But it is not easy to understand. It's basically by ostensive definition that you point at something, how you get it. And I worry about that. Only a small percentage of people ever used at Google the advanced search or at Yahoo ever personalized the homepage. So even for us who are high on an openness scale, we tend to have relatively narrow ways how we get stuff done.
As William James pointed out way back in 1890, one of the earliest really insightful psychologists, habit is a very powerful thing. Without habit, we couldn't run our lives at all. We have to be able to automatize most of what we do most of the time.
Or compile it as a computer scientist.
Yeah, compile it, automate it, overlearn it, so that we're free to think about the things that are novel and challenging. But the highly open are just a lot more comfortable with conscious reframing of their lives and their problems more often, more times throughout the day. And they'll be the ones who, if you say, look, here's Twitter, here's how it works, they might pay attention. Most people will, given novelty, just shut off. And they might get the demonstration, they might get the lecture, they might hear friends who use it, and they're just not interested.
That's difficult for us to understand how people cannot be interested in something. The curiosity is, I think, one of the most generous gifts I got from my parents. That, you know, it's always something interesting there if you're looking for it. Okay, so what I'm interested in is branding the way we know it traditionally tends to be a one-sided message, trying to interrupt the customer, potential customer. A potential customer is not viewed as a smart person who can actually help the company with the product. No, he is viewed as a subject, to be bombarded, to be targeted. Just think about that military term. Historically, and I know that you have a very generously long time scale of things, I always tell people, you know, when we lived in caves, but you are willing to go even further in history. Historically, it only was a very short period in the history of mankind that we didn't have true dialogue.
Yeah, we have to remember, I think, that throughout almost all of human evolution over the last 2 million years, just until 10,000 years ago when we invented agriculture, cities, domesticated animals, developed stratified societies, invented money, for the whole 2 million years, when the brain was tripling in size, when language was evolving, when we were living in small groups of hunter-gatherers where we knew everyone and everyone knew us, when we were communicating face-to-face, it was very much an interactive world. It was a world in which anybody who you encountered might be important in your life as a mate or a friend or a rival or an enemy. And it was very much before the era of mass media, mass marketing, mass product development, mass branding. So the notion of the corporation broadcasting messages about this is the product, this is how it will be construed, this is about the symbolic content of the product, our advertising will tell you what the product means, I think that era is over. There's now a dialogue between the consumer and the business, but also much richer dialogue among consumers.
Yes, it is really the dialogue between consumers where the conversations lie. And partly it's the fault of many businesses that they weren't listening. And as a consumer, if it's so easy for me to hit somebody up on Facebook, why is it so hard for me to get an answer from United Airlines?
It's very unnatural and it's extremely frustrating because humans are used to face-to-face dialogue with accountability and with responsiveness. And if you call a company and you get an infinite regression of a phone tree, or you get a person who's following a script, it's a real turnoff to people. It's the company acting as if we're not social primates, acting as if we haven't had 20 million years of learning how to understand each other's beliefs and desires and to take that into account when interacting. So one major way to turn off consumers is to ignore that wisdom that humans are social primates.
I gave a keynote earlier this year at a telco conference and asked the audience of these carriers that heretic question. Why didn't you stop asking yourself what you can do for the customer? And, you know, ask what can the customer actually do for you? And you would be surprised, given that you live in the communication business, which makes it easy for people to actually give stuff back to you, how many people are willing to chip in an area where they actually care? You wouldn't get them to fill out the 7-page survey in an area which they really couldn't care for. But telling you where the reception is bad, particularly if there's some epsilon chance that their life will be better afterwards, try to do that back channel, that, you know, bi-directional channel. So branding, I don't quite know what it is. People always lose me when they talk about branding. What really is branding?
Branding is a way to make an interchangeable commodity into a high profit item by virtue of its symbolic significance to the consumer. And most branding relies on the consumer realizing, if I acquire this product, it will serve a function for me in my social life or my sexual life. It will display a certain set of traits that I want to broadcast to the world, and it will do so credibly, accurately, in ways that other people understand. The function of advertising is basically to tell the consumer what traits will ownership of this product broadcast to the world about you, the owner. And advertising that doesn't succeed in making a clear message about the product and what kinds of people will buy it is going to fail.
Interesting that ads are not just to sell stuff, but it is to sell the thing around the stuff. To make people believe that they buy some attributes which at first sight have actually nothing to do with the product. Like Apple being a good example. The Jesus phone or iPhone, you can't really type on it, you can't really make phone calls, but hey, it's really cool.
The principal goal of most advertising, and advertisers should really realize this, is not to convince the tiny minority of consumers who might buy the product that the product is worth buying. Rather, it's to demonstrate to those consumers that all the other people out there are being instructed about the symbolic significance of this product. Give an example, BMW ads. They're not principally owned at potential BMW buyers. They're aimed at the people who might admire BMW owners or might find them sexy. It's programming all of that peer group into the symbolic and personality associations of the car. And that seems to be something advertisers don't quite get yet. That it's creating common knowledge about the significance of a certain brand as a symbol of personality traits.
In the social data revolution, where people share lots of information about themselves as well as about the relationships they have with others, does branding in the sense of informing the peer group what they should be thinking, should I buy that BMW? Is there still a space for that where people have direct communication to each other?
I think there's still a role for the advertising to create what economists call a focal point, a sort of little seed around which symbolic associations can aggregate. It's very hard for an individual to single-handedly create all of the associations that they might want to have associated with the things that they buy. The reason is, if they're just using a product idiosyncratically to convey meanings that they've invented about themselves, it's not effective. They might as well just try to convey that information through ordinary conversation. The advantage of using a branded product, to the extent that it has any advantage over ordinary conversation, is that the company has already done some of the work of broadcasting some of the possible symbolic associations to your peer group, your potential lovers, your potential friends. So the consumer is relying on the company to get those messages right, or to at least kickstart the whole symbolic exchange that might happen on Facebook or MySpace or Twitter or through text messaging.
Still, I feel that our attention is taken by what our friends share with us. Very little attention is left for what brands want us to believe. I have no television. I stopped listening to the radio when Bush became president. I have no newspaper. I have friends. And basically, not only is reality socially constructed, but reality for me is socially constructed by my friends. And they are like me because we look out for people who are, you know, similar to us. They don't have television either. They also stopped listening to the radio when Bush became president, and so on and so forth. So I really wonder whether there is any role left of significance in this over-communicating, always-on society where the role or the notion of friendship has changed, where you know what people are buying.
I think it's almost a luxury to have a peer group or a circle of friends who you know are bright enough, open-minded enough, have good enough judgment that you can trust what they get and their recommendations. Most people don't actually have that luxury. Most people know their own judgment and taste is fallible at best, and also that of their peers, their co-workers, their spouse is fallible. So if they could regularly interact with others face to face who they knew were high status, bright, open-minded, completely plugged into contemporary society, that would be great. But most of them don't have that luxury. They don't have the direct social connections to do that. And I think that's why most people tend to be quite conformist about the brands that they value. They rely on the mass communication still to help them along because they just don't have the peer group that has the confidence of judgment and taste, knowledge, and wealth to help them along.
How do you actually define peers? Are peers people who are just having identical standing, whether they know each other or don't, or are peers people who actually physically have encountered each other, at least know who the other person is?
Peers are anybody where you have what biologists would call overlapping fitness interests, where there's something you can do for them or they can do for you, whether it's trading goods or knowledge, whether it's trading genes, as with sexual partners, whether it's creating alliances and groups to accomplish some common purpose. So peers are anybody who have social or sexual significance in one's life. And the funny thing about modern consumer society is that out of the thousands of people we meet every day on the streets, if we live in a city, only a handful matter really to us. And yet we care a great deal about what these strangers may infer about us from what we're wearing, what we're driving, the brand of glasses we have, what kind of cell phone we have.
And you argue that this is because a few 10,000 years ago, we didn't really encounter that people in an ordinary day. And the chances that we better behave because that person might, you know, still be around for a while, that drove our behavior, and we haven't changed quick enough. The time scales of the DNA originated behavior are just much slower than the time scales of the technology induced behavior.
Yeah, we have this evolutionary lag. So we evolved in these small groups where there really weren't any strangers. And if someone came into the group, they would have implications for our fitness, our agenda, our relationships, our offspring, our kin. But now, we have these instincts that act as if everyone we meet, we should make a good impression on them. Rationally, that's not true. Rationally, it doesn't matter what most strangers think of you. You pass by thousands of people in an airport terminal, it doesn't matter. They don't care what you're wearing, what watch you have. There's no fitness benefit to you from the impression that they gain. And yet, we have these instincts that make us very concerned, that feel that their opinion of us is highly relevant in our lives.
There could be another explanation. The other explanation would be that, hey, you never know. That person who, you know, I just managed to ask my seat neighbor on that flight from New York to San Francisco whether he wouldn't mind sitting in economy. So that person in 22C could actually, you know, sit with me and we can have a conversation. You never know whether to be on the safe side, let's make a good impression because he might be or she might be the one.
The funny thing about that is to actually develop a relationship with anyone beyond the first few seconds, you have to talk to them. Talking is how people socialize. And conversation through verbal information sharing, through language, is the most powerful signaling system ever devised by any species. It's extremely rich, and it's wonderful how much we can reveal through the stories and anecdotes we tell. Compared to the power of language, the power of branding is a very distant second. And so, given the fact that even if you meet a stranger, you won't be able to cash out into any kind of relationship with them unless you spend at least a while talking to them. And during that conversation, they'll be able to judge all of your personality traits much more accurately than any of your product acquisitions will be able to display.
Like your place or my place kind of conversation.
Yeah, the kind of conversation where You're trying to be, you're unconsciously trying to be witty, interesting, and funny.
Yeah. By the way, it's interesting how many people being asked on Facebook why they comment. They say they want to be funny.
Absolutely. I mean, all the updates, like what are you doing at the moment? It's all about getting a laugh, getting people to think, getting people to think well of you, and to increase their estimation of your interestingness as a person by a notch or two.
But is it the same as the 100,000 people you're walking by in the city that, in my case, it'd be, hey, just in case one of my 500 Facebook friends might really be a person I want to get to know much better, I try to be funny for the remaining 499.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is the nature of human social life in terms of public displays. I mean, this is why people fear public speaking, because the potential costs and benefits are so high. It's a high-stakes game. Likewise, with public displays of musical ability or artistic ability or religious ritual or anything that we do in public to a large audience, it's a high-stakes game, and so is Facebook. Someone out there has a crush on you, and they're going to either be motivated to act on it or not based on what you say and what favorite bands and films you list. Conversely, you might provoke jealousy, rage, envy, all sorts of emotions in the other friends that you have.
So it used to be brands, then it used to be having a half hour of conversation after, you know, you notice that I have that nice diesel shirt for $300. But now, as the individual broadcasts himself or herself, that scarcity of attention of the other person, which I think is an important element in the mating behavior, that the person actually is attending to you, and that means your fear of rejection is reduced, and he's actually giving you something, his attention. So now, as I can broadcast to everybody I know, nobody might be listening, but that's a different question. As I broadcast to everybody potentially who I know, is that a stronger form or is that a weaker form of discovery of who the other person is and whether I want to meet them?
Of course, the best way to get someone else's attention is to convey something that's useful to them, right? A gift is the best kind of signal. So if you want to be interesting on Facebook, MySpace, or whatever, conveying useful, novel information in the context of being witty and interesting is a big win. It works well because it's attention-getting, because it fulfills an agenda of the audience, that they can in turn pass on this little new factoid or idea or music recommendation to their friends, and they can pass along this gift of information.
Okay, so that is for sharing interesting information, and I have to say I'm actually surprised how powerful that is. On the Facebook group we have, or Facebook fan page we have, Social Data Revolution, I learn interesting stuff there. It is just that if you have 500, 600 people who live in that space, and some of them are very good people, the ease of sharing data, information, changes the game.
And I think it's been the game changer that led humans to global dominance. I mean, that's the one trick that humans have, is exploiting the sort of positive sum game of information sharing much more effectively than any other animal. You know, if we try to spread limited physical resources like food amongst a group, it's zero sum. You divide the food up as you spread it. Information is positive sum. Just because I spread knowledge doesn't mean I lose it. I can share it, and the transaction costs of spreading it are virtually zero. And I think that's basically why humans are the last hominid standing, right? It's why we are by far the most successful primate on the planet, is we we actually entered this social data revolution in the sense of sharing useful information and broadcasting our trait signals to each other through language. We invented that probably about a million years ago, and it's been probably the most significant revolution in the history of life on Earth, actually.
So people want others to know their traits.
People love to display their traits, and they don't consciously strategize about this very much, but they have a very strong instinct to try to convey to others, I'm a certain kind of person, I have a certain level of intelligence, I have a certain level of openness, agreeableness, conscientiousness, and I have certain moral virtues that might be useful to you as a friend or a mate. So the whole game of a culture is, in my view, a culture is a system of trait display. It's a somewhat ritualized set of signals. It's a sort of informally codified game that says, in this society, here's how we display our intelligence to each other, or this is how we display conscientiousness to each other. It might be through adhering to religious rituals. It might be through getting certain kinds of education. It might be through having a certain credit score that indicates how reliably you remember to pay bills. There are all sorts of ways to do these trait displays. And every time there's a major shift in strategies of trait display, that is a key cultural shift.
What do you see the key cultural shift that is caused by the social data revolution, by people sharing primarily not that important things about themselves, but that at a high frequency?
I think the social data revolution is about people realizing the good old-fashioned power of conversation and language and interaction as a trait display game. It's realizing that actually you don't need brands if you have a chat room. You don't really need to rely on meanings that are created by advertisers as a symbolic crutch. You can create your own meanings interactively. And since the only people who matter in your life probably number in the single digits or the dozens, you know, you can have conversations with these people. They get to know your traits, you get to know their traits, and that's all you really need in life.
That's really a wonderful perspective.
Thanks, Andreas.
Thank you, Jeffrey.